This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, 30 days with the iPhone.
The iPhone turned me from skeptic to believer in a matter of minutes. It's definitely the future of handheld devices.
We try and pry the iPhone away from Graham Barlow long enough to talk about his day-to-day experiences with the handheld marvel. And a welcome addition to the database world from FileMaker.
This little gem looks like it could have been designed by Apple. It looks like it's the fourth iWork program. Beautifully designed, easy to use, approachable, and cheap. What more can you ask from a bit of OS X software?
Chris Finn tells us about Bento and an update to Stuff It Deluxe. All that and more on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. If you've been holding off buying an iPhone, the UK's iPhone carrier, O2, has now made it tougher to fight the urge. On the 29th of January, O2 overhauled its pricing plans for the iPhone, lowering prices and tacking on more minutes and text messages. Here's the rundown. The £55-a-month package has been dropped and a new £75 monthly deal introduced. O2's existing £35 and £45 monthly tariffs remain in place, with a greater allocation of minutes and text for each one. Customers currently paying £55 per month will automatically be switched to the £45 monthly deal, which has the same amount of minutes and texts as the former £55 tariff. So why the change? O2 says it has nothing to do with the fact that the phone isn't selling, but rather to hook more customers into getting the phone who have found the pricing just too expensive. Okay, so now you're thinking, maybe I should look at the iPhone one more time. What better way to help you decide than to hear from one guy who tried it out for 30 days and reported his findings in the February issue of Mac Format. Editor Graham Barlow did just that in his feature entitled, My Month with the iPhone. I recently spoke to Graham about his iPhone experiences and began by asking him if he was addicted to the iPhone within the first day.
I mean, pretty much, yeah. My cynical journalistic reserve completely dissolved, and I just, you know, just completely fell in love with it. It's such a great product. You know, I mean, it's expensive. There's a few negatives. I defy anyone not to enjoy using this phone.
What did you like about the phone the most?
I mean, really, it's the screen. It's the fact that you can go to web pages, zoom in, zoom out again. You can flick up and down on lists just with your finger. It's just the physically using the device is pleasurable, which it can't be said for any other phone that I'm aware of.
Now, we'll get into some of the other features you like the most a little bit later, but there were some things you didn't like, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the best phone for me, but it's not perfect still. There's quite a few things that, you know, need improving. For a start, the camera. The camera that's built in, it just isn't good enough for me. It's fine on bright, sunny days, but as soon as you lose a bit of the light, your shots all come out very dark. Also, people want a 3G version of the phone, which will be faster. I kind of found Edge to be okay for what I wanted to do, but if it had been faster, that would have been better too.
Right, I can understand that. Setting aside the obvious that it's a mobile phone you can make calls with, what makes it so valuable when you take all the sums of the parts and put them together?
It's just the ease of use. And again, if you just look at the spec sheet for the iPhone, you won't get that sense of what it's like to use it. It's not until you get it in your hand and have a go. The way it brings everything together into an easy-to-use package that's actually fun to use as well as just letting you get on with things, that is the kind of the best thing about the iPhone. It's just the sheer ease of use.
Now, I asked you a minute ago what you liked about the phone, but this is really a kind of a different question. What's your favorite or most usable feature of the phone?
Okay, two things for me. First of all, web browsing. That's what I do the most of on the iPhone. Quite often, I'll sit home in the evening. Instead of using my MacBook to browse the web, I'll just use the iPhone because the experience of browsing the web is so good on it that it's replaced my Mac as my kind of home internet browser.
Right.
Secondly, the iPod. The second most use I get out of it isn't as a phone, it's as an iPod. Because, I mean, I listen to the iPod a lot, so I've got it on most of the day, you know, when I'm not talking to you on the podcast.
Right.
I'm sitting there listening to music, and it's all done on the iPhone. And that's, instead of having to have an iPod and a phone in my pocket, I'm only carrying one device, and it does all of it.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago the web browsing. The iPhone uses a combination of the Edge network from O2 and the Wi-Fi network from the cloud network. Tell us how seamless the two networks were in your testing.
Okay, when you're going on Wi-Fi, once you've connected to your Wi-Fi hotspot, and it isn't complicated, or you don't have to put in a whole load of complicated digits and stuff to sign on, once you're connected, you're just on, which is fantastic. And then if you're out of range of the hotspot, it just automatically switches to Edge, if you can get Edge in your area. When you've got the iPhone, you've got free access to the cloud, which are a network of hotspots around the country. During testing in Bath, I had a few problems getting onto the cloud network. I kind of just assumed that there was something wrong with the phone or there's something wrong that I was doing wrong, but I got onto the cloud's technical support and they kind of tested out those locations and found they had problems. So it wasn't a great start for me in the cloud, but once they corrected them and got those locations back up and working, it worked fine.
Out of all your diary postings over the 30 days, I think this one is very telling. You wrote, quote, "The iPhone is probably the first device that gives a hint of what's going to be possible in the future. I've noticed that I've actually stopped using my Mac for casual web browsing at home and started using the iPhone instead," unquote. Now, you start to think about what you've written, and you notice that despite the speed of web browsing and the occasional problems of finding a reliable network connection, you didn't preface your comments that the experience wasn't unusable. I think that says a lot about the iPhone and the future of handheld technology, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of handheld internet devices, I think this is the first one that's got it right. I mean, nothing else I've used. I mean, I've used things like BlackBerry, blah, blah, blah. It's just not a good experience browsing the web on something like that. But the iPhone is the first time I've kind of seen a future for not having a computer in the traditional sense as your main internet device.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got it right completely.
The new firmware update that Steve Jobs released at the Apple keynote, that's version 1.1.3, it delivers new features like the ability to send SMS messages to multiple recipients at once, GPS tracking on Google Maps via triangulation, Google Maps showing off the hybrid map view, drag and drop icons on the home screen, and web clip bookmarks on the home screen, just to name a few. Which of these do you like the best and why?
I mean, all of them are good. I really like the way you can customize a home screen. It's very cleverly done, and it reminds me of Spaces on Leopard, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The way you can have kind of multiple screens. All I've done immediately is just put all the icons I never ever use onto a separate screen, so I never have to see them again. So, you know, I've got my stocks and shares icon that I never press off my home screen, so that's one less bit of clutter.
Right.
Of course, I've then cluttered up my home screen with loads and loads of little web clips, which are, yeah, so, you know, what they give with one hand, they take away with another.
Yeah, so there are definitely some pitfalls. Let's talk about the future here. What new features would you like to see in the next revision of the iPhone?
I would like to see what everyone wants to see, which is 3G. I can live with Edge, it's fine, but everyone wants 3G, so why not? Let's have 3G.
Well, the great thing here, Graham, is that we know that the O2 network is really improving. I was just talking to a guy at O2 a few days ago, and he told me that they've got 85% coverage of 3G. So if Apple were to come out with a 3G iPhone very soon, they're ready to switch that network over, and the coverage is pretty good, they say.
Oh, that's excellent news because, I mean, I think we'll get it this year.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a better camera too. The camera on the iPhone, it's just not up to it. It needs a better camera and it really needs a flash. If I had to have one more addition to the iPhone, it would be some way of user replacing the battery. I mean, I've actually got a little device here in my hand, which is a battery dock for the iPod, which charges. It kind of plugs into the dock at the bottom of the iPod, which is a solution. It's called backup battery for iPhone, and it works pretty well. It gives you about half a charge. But if there's some way that you could take the back off and put another battery in, it would just solve all those problems.
Well, that brings up the obvious question. Were you finding yourself constantly running out of battery power and juice on the iPhone?
I'm kind of quite paranoid about checking how much power I've got left. So, you know, I sit at my desk most of the day. I can just power up whenever I want to. But I think, you know, you need to power it up, or recharge rather, you know, overnight, pretty much every day.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you kind of get into the routine of doing that, you're fine. But if you forget, you are going to find you'll run out of power.
And that's why you're saying you really need the ability to replace that battery.
I need to have a kind of a charged battery ready just for those emergency moments where you're too low on power and you've got to make a phone call.
Okay, so you had the phone a month. This is not a cheap product. £269 for the phone and a signed minimum 18-month tariff plan at £25 a month. All that totals about £900. That's a lot of money for a phone. Is it worth all that?
It is a lot of money for a phone. The tariff plans do compare with other mobile providers offering, you know, data packages as well. They're not particularly more expensive. But then again, you've got to factor into the cost, the iPhone, the handset cost as well. I think the answer is, if you make a lot of phone calls, it is worth it. But if you don't, then there's always the iPod Touch, which has a lot of the features, especially with the, you know, it's now got the mail client on there, address book and stuff.
Access to the web via the cloud network, if you want to, for an additional price.
That's right. You know, it does web browsing. If you're only kind of in your house and then at work, then do you really need to have, you know, the mobile internet? I think, you know, it's up to you, basically. basically. If you're the sort of person that does make a lot of phone calls or, you know, a lot of texting, then go for the phone. If you're not, then that's what the iPod Touch is for.
All right, Graham, thanks so much for going over the main features and what you liked and didn't like about the iPhone for a month. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad. Cheers. Bye.
Graham Barlow is the editor of Mac Format. His four-page feature entitled My Month with the iPhone appears on page 18 in the February issue of Mac Format magazine. It's a bento box, but we're not talking about sushi here. Mac Format Deputy Editor Chris Finn joins us with his reviews of a new personal database from the makers of FileMaker and an update of a popular compression utility. Chris, thanks for joining us again. We're both back from San Francisco, and I've still got the cold I think that you gave me on the West Coast. Thanks so much.
I'm a generous soul, Brad. How are you?
I'm very good, sir. Let's begin with your review of a new personal database that is actually turning some heads. It's called FileMaker Bento. Tell us what this product is all about.
Okay, so when you say personal database, already I'm asleep. It sounds dull, it sounds boring, it sounds like an account, the sort of thing an accountant would use. And to an extent, you're right. But think about it. iTunes is a database. You know, iPhoto is a database. Just because it says the word database doesn't mean it's not interesting. And Bento is a fantastic and really, really interesting little app for this big hulking corporation, FileMaker, to have produced. As you say, it's a personal database. It's for just one person to use, maybe a small business trader or somebody who wants to track a holiday they're going to go on or a dinner party they're having. It's a small, single-user application, and it's a way of just taking in a bunch of data, organizing it in certain ways, and outputting it in different ways as well. Now, the really nice thing about Bento is that while FileMaker has been for years making the preeminent Mac database app, FileMaker Pro, which is big and complex and rich, and you can do anything with it, and it looks really clean, really simple, friendly, approachable. I mean, you've seen it, Brad. It doesn't it? It looks like the fourth iWork app. It's such an Apple-like application.
Yeah, it really is so simple to use. I mean, I saw this product on a brand new MacBook that they were giving away Bento for free for brand new users just to beta test. And I found it so powerful. I learned it like in 2 minutes with no manual. It was that great. And I just absolutely loved it. So how do you bring in information to Bento?
There's a few different ways. Bento will accept in CSV files, comma separated value files, which is a very sort of standard way of moving sort of tabular data between different applications. It doesn't accept Excel files natively, but Excel can export to CSV, so you can do it that way. One of the reasons actually that Bento hasn't come out before now is that with Leopard, with 10.5, and I should point out actually that Bento is 10.5 only, but with 10.5, Apple introduced a bunch of APIs for its personal information manager applications, address book and iCal effectively. Now, what's an API? An API is a developer's hook. It's a way for developers to get into the data that an application holds. Apple has allowed third-party developers to hook directly into the data that iCal and address book hold. So what you actually do, whenever you load up Bento, it automatically looks at your iCal and address book data. And every time you're moving that data around, either in address book and iCal or in Bento, you're dealing with the same data at the end of it, the same sort of pool of data.
Right.
So you make a change to an entry in iCal, in Bento, it's reflected in iCal instantly because they're both looking at the same data. It's really, really neat, and it means there's no mucking about. It means it's really simple to import your data, and you're always using the most up-to-date stuff.
Now, Bento is very simple and powerful, but it's not the kitchen sink. What does Bento not do, and who is it really for?
It's by no means even a small work group application. You can't share the data easily between different users, so you couldn't have a small team of people using the one database. It's not integrated into Mail at all. So you might be familiar with Daylight from Market Circle, which is a very good sort of business level app. So you can tie up stuff with Daylight from your Mail client into Daylight. So you can, if you get an invitation to an appointment, you can put stuff in that way. You can manage ingoing and outgoing emails for like sales or invoice and that sort of stuff. You can't do that with Bento. Bento only integrates with Address Book and iCal, so there's no integration with Mail. So it's not a fully fledged sort of business CRM or anything like that. Uh-huh. It's a very simple, very plain little database. And the sort of people who'd use it are sole traders, people looking, so there's a bunch of pre-built templates which look very, very slick for things like asset tracking, so you can track where your equipment is on site. So it's very much a single user thing.
But all in all, you gave Bento 5 out of 5 stars. You really liked it. It was simple to use. It looked great. It's a really good value at £29. And it easily builds attractive forms and attractive databases very quickly. That's why you really loved it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that price is crucial as well. £29, you really can't argue with it. It's such a phenomenally well-developed little application. There's a bunch of really nice stuff in here that we don't usually see from third-party developers. They don't really get the Apple thing. So, for example, I'm sure you tried as well when you're using Bento, when you create calculations as you can. So you can create not only static fields, but you can have the fields interact. So when you create calculations, you're not doing that sort of nasty Excel thing of doing sort of equal sum A4 plus C9.
Right.
You actually are dragging and dropping elements of the calculations from your fields into a calculations field of its own. Really simple way of doing things. There are some rough edges, there's some stuff I'd like to see tightened up, but all in all, it's such a stunning debut from FileMaker for this little personal database app. Cracking little thing.
It really is. FileMaker Bento, £29, a Mac format choice, 5 out of 5 stars. You've got to check it out online at FileMaker. They've got a demo that you can play with for free. It's really worth taking a look at. Our second product we're going to review is Stuffit Deluxe 12. Now, this is a famous compression utility that compresses and uncompresses JPEG images, one of many things that it does, but now it's got some new features in version 12. Tell us about them.
The big feature in the previous version, as you say, was this improved JPEG compression. Now, I'm not going to bore you rigid, I promise, but compression is actually quite interesting, and the way they get around it, because they claim that they can compress your JPEGs further without any loss in quality, which is true, because JPEG compression is actually a two-stage compression thing, so there's no data loss in that whatsoever. And it's that second part of the process that Smith Micro has improved, that lossless encoding of the lossy encoded data, they've actually improved, so they can do it. And with this version as well, they've added support for MP3s and for PDFs. So exactly the same idea. You take the compressed file, obviously PDF and MP3 as well as JPEG, and it re-encodes and recompresses them in a much more intelligent way without losing any more data. That's the promise.
But it really doesn't sometimes ring true. You ran some benchmark compression tests of Stuffit Deluxe 12. What did you find?
That's right. The most impressive results were with JPEGs. So I took about 6 gig of JPEGs, compressed them using OS X's built-in zip compression, and it basically lost nothing. It lost about 1.3% of its total size. With Stuffit, it did much better. It lost a quarter, so it went down to about 4.5 gigs. So that's an impressive stat. But the things were much, much less impressive with MP3s and with PDFs. So with PDFs, Stuffit only outperformed the OS level compression by about 3%, and with MP3s it was just over a half of a percent, 0.53% better than the OS's own .zip compression. Now, the rates of compression aren't everything, because I mean, Stuffit has a bunch of more stuff in there that makes it a really compelling proposition for anybody who does a lot of compression.
Right.
But that's not to say that the ratios of compression is the only thing that's important, and there's a bunch of stuff in Stuffit 12 that make it a much more compelling proposition if you do a lot of this sort of stuff.
Now tell us some of those things that do make it a better proposition for some.
Well, one of the most obvious things is that with Stuffit, you can have, at the end of a stuffing session, you can have it automatically upload that file to an FTP server. So at Mac Format, we use this sort of thing all the time because we're constantly having copies submitted into us from our freelance writers, and we're moving files around the system. So we use FTP a lot. So the ability just to say, right, take this bunch of files, the InDesign document and its linked graphics, stuff it all up and then chuck it in the FTP automatically, that's great. Stuffit also allows you to split files into particular size chunks. So if you've got a 12 gigabyte file that you want to burn onto disk, Stuffit can say, right, what size of disk do you have? Is it a DVD-R? Sure. I'll split that into the chunks for you so that you're not having to try and... there would be another way to do it, because it splits into the right size of chunks so you can burn onto the DVD. Stuff like that. Stuff that makes it simpler and easier if you do a lot of it. But bear in mind as well that the OS can replicate some of that functionality with Automator. So a bunch of that sort of stuff can be replicated. And that's really the root of my problem with Stuffit. It's a great app, very slick, very nice, beautifully presented, tons of functionality in there. What do you want? Anything you want. Compression, it's your man. but who needs all that?
All right, Stuff It Deluxe 12, 60 pounds, 4 out of 5 stars Chris gave it, despite some of the criticism we just gave it that many of its features are built into OS X. It's still a good and valuable compression utility, Stuff It Deluxe 12. Chris, thanks so much for going over Bento, which is a fantastic new product, and the upgrade to Stuff It Deluxe.
My pleasure, Brad. Hope your cold gets well soon.
By the time you see me next time, this cold will be history. Chris, thanks so much for the time. We'll talk to you down the road. Chris Finn is the deputy editor of MacFormat Magazine. A web page snapper and an Able icon editor. Those are the two shareware picks for the February issue of MacFormat Magazine. We'll review them now with Craig Grinnell. How are you, Craig?
I'm good. How are you, Brad?
Very good. Thanks again for joining us, Craig. Each month we review his two shareware favorites, and if you're watching on our enhanced version of the podcast, you can link directly to the websites of these two products by clicking on the image link. And let's begin with our first product. It is WebSnapper, the beta version 2.0. It's about $8 from Tasty Apps at tastyapps.com. The application enables you to take grabs of web pages and is in fact an update of what was originally called Red Snapper, which we covered about 9 months ago, right, Craig?
Yeah, that's the case. What actually happened with Red Snapper and other Tasty apps is they all kind of fell apart when Leopard showed up with Safari 3, because it used to be just a direct Safari plugin, but now Web Snapper's actually an entirely separate application, a standalone application.
Now, screen grab functions, as many people know, are built into OS X, and PDFs can be saved from Safari. So why is Web Snapper really needed?
Well, the problem with the PDFs that you save directly from Safari is they're multi-page. And, you know, that's kind of fine if you want to print something out. But if you just want to create something as an archive, like if you find a really good article and you want a digital copy of it, it's good to have sort of full-length PDFs, like, you know, a single-page PDF that's as long as it needs to be,
right?
Rather than splitting up the pages. And Web Snapper enables you to do that. But also, say you're a web designer and you want to create copies of portfolio-type sites you've done, Web Snapper can do that too. You can take a full-length grab of a web page rather than taking loads of different grabs and stitching them together in Photo. And one of the other things as well is that WebSnapper enables you to output to a whole bunch of graphic formats like JPEG, PNG, and TIFF.
Now, RedSnapper was a Safari plugin previously. How does WebSnapper compare?
Well, funnily enough, I actually prefer it. I kind of liked the workflow with RedSnapper. You know, you had a Safari toolbar button, you clicked it, you saved your picture. But somehow having it as a standalone app, it kind of feels more flexible. I mean, firstly, it's no longer tied to Safari. You can use Firefox or any other Mac-based browser. And as a standalone app, it actually works pretty well. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not quite as straightforward as it was in Safari, but it's pretty obvious. You basically drag the URL or favelite icon from the browser toolbar directly to WebSnapper. You click a download button, and then you get a save dialog, and then you just save in whatever format you want to. And I think the other thing as well, as a standalone app, there are no real stability issue concerns from adding extras to Safari or any other browser for that matter.
All right, so WebSnapper 2.0 beta, it's about £4 from tastyapp.com, and you can link to it through the Enhanced podcast. Craig, you really liked it because it's still just as good as it was before, even better in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really great app. If you need to take any archive of any reason from any website, it's actually pretty much a perfect solution.
All right, that's WebSnapper. Let's move on to our second product. And again, it's an update to a previous product that really makes it even better, and that is Candy Bar 3, which cost about £15, $29. What is Candy Bar?
Well, it's kind of like iTunes for icons. I mean, Mac users like tinkering with their icons, but, you know, you don't really want to go into a Get Info dialog box all the time to copy things out.
Right.
And also, some of the system icons are kind of hard to get at. You know, they're kind of buried in system files. And with something like, you know, when Leopard showed up, there were a lot of people kind of annoyed by the way the folders look, for example. Not many people are a huge fan of them. And so Candy Bar is something which can enable you to basically organize, manage, and switch icons throughout your entire system. And in fact, it's kind of a combination of two panic applications, the previous version of Candy Bar, which was used for switching icons, and also their Pixodex application, which was a kind of excellent management application.
Now, Candy Bar's got a really beautiful user interface. So tell us, how easy is it to use?
Well, one of the things that Panic's known for in the industry is interfaces that are beautiful and easy to use. They've got real good UI conventions under the hood, everything. And Candy Bar is really no exception to that. It's kind of intuitive all the way through. You can drop individual icon files onto specific locations in the interface to switch out specific icons. You also have icon tainers, which are entire sets of icons that you can grab from iconfactory.com and other places, and you can load those in. And you can automate that process. You kind of tell it to install an entire bunch of iContainer resources, and it will do it automatically. You can mix and match sets and icons by dragging and dropping, by dragging off specific things, dragging on other things. And you can also, if you build a set yourself, which is very, very easy to do, you can automate where specific icons are applied on a case-by-case basis. So very, very flexible. What I just said there kind of sounds, in a way, a bit complicated, but it totally, totally isn't. You know, you start using it, it's very, very simple, very Mac-like, and probably one of Panic's best creations, actually, in that regard.
So what happens if you don't like your choices? How can you get your system back to how it was?
Well, the thing is, changing icons isn't particularly dangerous. It's not like you're wrenching system resources out of your Mac and messing with them. But the thing is, it is an entirely non-destructive process when you're using Candy Bar. There are big restore buttons that kind of sit there once you've made changes, and all you have to do is basically click those. It reverts the resources. I mean, sometimes you're going to have to do something like log out, log back in again, or restart Finder, and sometimes you're given options to do that from within the application. But ultimately, it's pretty much fail-safe, risk-free process.
All right, that's Candy Bar version 3.0 from the guys at Panic Software at panic.com/candybar. And again, the price of Candy Bar is £15. Also, if you want to find out more about working with Candy Bar, Craig has written a great tutorial in the February issue of the magazine, which begins on page 64. So again, Candy Bar 3.0, 5 out of 5 stars. You really like this one because it really is easy to use and, more importantly, easy to restore if you make changes.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of people are kind of scared of messing with their computer, and you know, icons, in a way, are no exception in people's heads. But when an application like this comes along, it makes it very, very easy to do everything. You know, you can organize, you can manage, you can switch things, and you know that all the way through you're safe because the application's got your back.
All right, Craig, thanks so much for going over WebSnapper and Candy Bar, which appear in the February issue. Thanks so much.
All right, see you next month.
Craig Grinnell reviews shareware for MacFormat magazine. His shareware picks for February begin on page 100 in MacFormat magazine. It's time for our regular questions and answers segment with Trevor Middleton. Hi, Trevor.
Hi there, Brad. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for joining us again. On each episode, Trevor will do his best to answer your questions about your Mac or iPod or your iPhone. But before we begin, we'd like to tell you, always send us your questions and Trevor will do his best to answer them for you. You can email us at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Our first question is from Rod Cockrell in New South Wales, which is near Sydney, Australia. He wrote us, after 20 years as a Windows user, I bought a 17-inch Intel Core 2 Duo iMac with a Mighty Mouse, which at first I had difficulty controlling. It would jump around erratically and activate Exposé by itself at random. Sometimes it would make a clicking sound when my hand simply hovered near it. Now, I sell Macs for a living, and I soon encountered another user with the same problem. To cut a long story short, it turns out to be poor grounding from a noisy power line that's causing the issue. Are you aware of this problem? Trevor.
Well, Rob, this does seem to be a problem with a number of users, and it's almost invariably related to a badly earthed or grounded electricity supply. If you have a space in your home you're regularly using as an office, it's worth making sure that the power sockets comply with your local regulations and that your supply is properly grounded. And I know from experience, mine wasn't until I had a friend who's an electrician check out my power supply, and he found that the external earthing wasn't properly applied, so worth getting that checked. In general, also, you could try to use a mouse mat that won't encourage the buildup of static electricity. Or, if you want to be really extreme about it, you could get rid of all the carpets in your workspace, which again will avoid the buildup of static electricity. But yes, it does seem to be related to badly grounded electricity supplies, Rod. Brad.
Okay, question two is from Christian Edwards, who wrote us from Wrexham in North Wales. And he writes, I'm a new Mac user. I bought a secondhand Power Mac G4 in August of 2007, which is great, but I have a small problem. Whenever I switch it off, it restarts, even though I chose shutdown from the Apple menu. The problem has become so bad that I have to unplug the power cord to turn it off. Any ideas of how to sort this out?
Well, first of all, I saw this question and I had a mild panic attack because it is very, very unwise to turn off any computer by unplugging it at the mains. You can cause all kinds of system corruption and even hard disk damage by doing that. The best way to shut down a Mac that's exhibiting the symptoms similar to yours is to press and hold the power button until it turns itself off. And that will actually sometimes cure the problem. If it still misbehaves after that, you might need to take the Mac to your local Apple authorized service provider and have the power management unit reset. Not a job I'd try myself as a new Mac user. Otherwise, you should get years of long service out of that Power Mac G4. Brad.
All right. Question three is from Katie Smith of San Rafael, California, who wrote us, I recently acquired a business email account. I cannot, however, figure out how to set up the account with Mac Mail. Everyone seems to have a different set of options on what will and will not work. I can go so far, but after the last bit in the setup process in Mail, it tells me that it is checking connection to SMTP server, and I just get stuck from there. What should I do? Trevor.
Okay, well, Katie, if you're sending emails using a mail client such as Mac Mail or Outlook Express, you'll usually have to do it via the SMTP, that's the outgoing mail server, of the network you're connecting to, usually either your internet service provider or your cell phone network. If you attempt to send emails via another company's SMTP server, which is what you're describing, your access will be blocked as it's detected as a potential attempt to relay junk mail. The answer? Try putting your ISP's SMTP server details in the settings for that account, and you should have more luck with that. When it comes to transferring the account to your mobile handset, which you said you want to do, you'll need to check with your network, as you'll normally have to change the SMTP server to your network's. Alternatively, if you have a Google Mail account, you might be able to use Google's SMTP server details, whichever network you're on. I know I've used them with T-Mobile in the UK, though you might need to use password authentication. The bottom line is here, check with your network. Brad.
All right, Trevor, yeoman's job again. Thanks so much. We'll see you on the next show.
Thank you kindly, sir. See you next time.
You can email us at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk, and please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format this week. My thanks to Graham Barlow, Chris Finn, Craig Grinnell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakharopoulou. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 18th of February. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.